Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're about to talk to Will Hilton, who's been covering the show for many years. The articles he's written, his magazine pieces, his trip to Cuba, many things where we first met during that when you made that trip with
Louis Rouse.
Louis Rouse.
Yeah.
And we had a conversation about that many years back, and has become a serious magazine writer, done many good things. And now he's written his first book, which is really an amazing story, and also a story that is extremely well written. I don't say that easily. Extremely well written. It's called Vanished, the 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. And, Will, welcome. Good to have you with us, man.
Thanks. It's good to see you.
Family well? Life is good?
Everything's good. Yeah, we're back in Baltimore, which is wonderful.
And people are loving this book.
Ah, I'm glad to hear it. It's 5 years of my life, and it's just wonderful that it's not all in my head anymore.
Folks, if you want to, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. If you haven't read the book, it might be hard. Maybe you have experiences as if you're a surviving veteran or a child or grandchild of a World War II vet. This may speak to you and Vietnam vets as well. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can also log on to our Facebook pages and, of course, tweet at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. This is interesting because this book started as a magazine article that grabbed you so deeply you had to write a book about it is what I heard.
That's right, yeah. I just couldn't stop. I mean, part of it was that as I was working on the magazine article, I was discovering that there was a lot more mystery in this story than I had initially been led to believe. I sort of was a journalist embedded with the military unit that recovers the remains of missing service members who've died in combat but never been fully accounted for in past wars, often in far-flung parts of the globe. And the first of many sites that they were taking me to show me how they work was this huge barge in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And I got out there just to kind of see how they worked and what they do. And there were all these elite military personnel from all the different services. The greatest number were these Navy deep sea divers who do this amazing work. They strap on hard hat helmets like you see in the old movies, and they would jump off the edge of the barge in pairs and go down to the bottom of the ocean, and then be down there for an incredible amount of time and come up with baskets full of debris. And so I started trying to figure out what's down there. What are they doing? I know it's related to recovering human remains, but is this a ship? Is this an airplane? How many people are they looking for? And they were not particularly forthcoming with the information about it, which I later came to appreciate is because they're afraid that if they let you know what the hopeful target is, that they'll raise the anticipation of the family members.
And I want to get into the heart of that. I mean, because the people you've come up with this in book and the stories, and you've went into the history, and you brought us through combat in this book with literally taking us through what happened in combat, from the words and lives of the soldiers to the families that are trying to find their loved ones. I think that you have these great lines in here. I'm going to just read this a bit. We can talk about this for a minute, then go into Pat Scanlon and Eric Emery, and
sure.
that inspired you to do this book. But you wrote in here, this quoting somebody, Hunter King, that unlike the Holocaust, mothers of MIA children, missing in action children, were not suddenly uprooted from their homes and deprived of their possessions, countries, and cultures. They didn't lose siblings, parents, husbands to programmed incineration. They were not subjected to incarceration, underfed, and abused as were Holocaust victims. And go on to talk about that. But most of these missing in action adult children, unless they are convinced and their fullest public accounting has been made, and or unless the father's remains are located, adequately identified, and returned to the family, their prolonged and ambiguous grieving will continue indefinitely, and that over the past century, some 82,000 service members have been listed as missing of whom 73,000 disappeared in World War II, 56,000 alone in the Pacific Theater. And to put it another way, as you write, the number of men who disappeared in the war against Japan makes up two-thirds of all missing service members, roughly the same total of number of combat deaths in Vietnam. That's a huge number of people.
Staggering, isn't it?
Fathers, grandfathers' generation.
Yeah.
Missing.
Yeah. And, you know, this has been sort of the process that I've gone through in reporting the book, is from this most external of stories in this far-flung, you know, Pacific Islands on this cool barge with all of these military personnel doing this very, you know, high-tech work, to the other end of the spectrum, this most interior of stories about what the experience is for families who are waiting for this unit and for these kinds of search teams to bring home answers about what really happened to their loved one. And I say loved one because these guys are obviously sons and brothers and husbands. But for many of the people who are affected deeply by the loss, they're also great uncles, and much more far removed relations. And what happens in these families is that the family carries this loss. And in the literature, it's referred to as the intergenerational transmission of trauma. But what that really means is that the pain is passed down through subsequent generations of the family, and doesn't ever really go away. It's very different from the kind of grief that you encounter in a typical combat casualty, where it's at least there's some resolution to what happened. When the person is declared killed in action, you have something to spend years coping with. When the person is declared missing, what families tend to do is struggle with the question of whether they're dead or alive. And they often craft a very sort of hopeful narrative in their minds of what may have happened, what they would like to have happened, in the same way that parents of a missing child do. And you find time and time again when you speak with the MIA families that because they've held on to this kind of hope, they can't really move on or put the story or the loss behind them.
Now, well, let's talk about some of the people that you discovered that kind of really pushed you to do this book, and the work that they did, and the family stories that you kind of unearthed as well. Because you didn't just write a book about this kind of general book. I mean, you met with the families. You kind of pulled out from the archives of College Park. You told the stories that one which I hope we get to do, which is about what happened, why the Japanese became so hard during World War II to prisoners, and you put that issue on the table, and, you know, where the people came from in the South Pacific, it's all there. It's this kind of in-depth history and look at what this whole world's about. But let's talk about Eric Emery and Pat Scanlon. Start with Eric Emery.
So Eric Emery, I guess in a way both he and Pat Scanlon are people who you could say wound up at the same coordinates as that military barge over a lifetime of sort of unidirectional unconscious movement. Emery and also Scanlon, from a very young age, felt this pull towards a certain direction in his life. And he began studying history, but then realized that he was more interested in archaeology as the sort of physical manifestation of his interest in history, and had spent many years as a child sailing in Lake Champlain. And when during his studies in archaeology and in history, crossed paths with a Lake Champlain underwater expedition to look for underwater archaeological remnants of an old Revolutionary War era bridge, he discovered that he was interested in doing his historical archaeological research underwater. And then he found that doing that work lacked the sort of emotional resonance that he hoped for, looking for potsherds. He had a very close encounter where he almost died doing the work, and it no longer felt to him like it was worth it just to find relics of an ancient civilization. So he found himself applying for and accepting a position at the military unit as a civilian working for the military in this recovery operation. And by the time I encountered Emery, he was on the barge as the lead anthropologist on this operation, about which he was unwilling to say much to me at the time. But
because, as you said, they were keeping this close to the vest until they didn't want families to get the wrong idea and to think that something was being found when it wasn't, and the emotional tug it would have on families.
You only have to see one of these things go wrong to understand why they do that. And so it's a tough policy to have. I mean, it's enormously frustrating for families all the time. There are families all around the country who are frustrated that they can't get definitive answers as to whether an operation is underway for their relatives' wreckage and remains, or whether it's on the schedule. A lot of these things are fairly opaque, and that's very frustrating for families. But you only have to see it happen once, where a family is notified that something has been found, and it turns out not to be the case, and the devastation is just unbearable. These families are already, deeply, deeply affected by this loss, and the ripples of grief that add to the tsunami from false information is totally unacceptable. So they have to take this sort of all threats posture with regard to information.
Now, the Pat Scannon, I mean, he's a major character in this book.
Yeah.
A really complex man.
Yeah.
And his journey to flying this flight and what they found in the beginning when he first took this dive. We're talking about Flight 453, which is the saga of this book, and Pat Scannon to get to the bottom of this flight.
Yeah. I opted to tell the story of the Pacific War and the missing, who, as you mentioned, represent the majority of all missing personnel over the last century. When your missions are over these 1,000-mile stretches between tiny little islands, you go down in the water, and so the recovery rate is pretty low. And yet I wanted to make sure that the story was a story, and it wasn't a recitation of statistics. So I told it very specifically in the book about through the eyes of this character Pat Scannon, who was working as a medical researcher for about a dozen years before he became involved in any of this. He's a physician, an MD with a PhD in chemistry, and worked, had actually founded a biotech firm in California, which he then handed off to other executives so he could focus on this very sort of arcane research into monoclonal antibodies. And spent 12 years doing 70-hour weeks of work and was really in need of a vacation, and went out on this scuba diving expedition to the Palau Islands, which he knew nothing about, but he had some friends who were going. And it was while there, purely by chance, that he happened upon this massive airplane wing from a B-24 bomber.
While diving in the water.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it just stopped him in his tracks. And I mean that not only in regard to that day, but I think it's fair to say that it stopped the course of his life and changed its direction. That was 1993. In that moment, he said he experienced this sensation that's so clearly lodged in his memory, and by hearing it in mine, of coldness, actual coldness creeping from his toes to his scalp.
I remember that line you wrote. Yeah,
it was really a striking thing to hear him say. And he knew immediately that he was going to look for the rest of that plane. He needed to know how many men had been aboard, and whether their families knew what had happened to them. And that, 20 years ago now, he's still looking. He's expanded his search to include all the missing aircraft in the Palau Islands. So he may spend the rest of his life looking. But I think that if you asked Pat Scannon today, he would say that this is the great ambition of his life, is to provide closure for as many of these families as
possible. And he has done for some.
Yes, he has, yeah.
But this obsession became your obsession.
It did. There may be a third. There's Eric Emery who followed that course. Then there's Pat Scannon who followed his course. Scannon and Emery don't really know each other. I think they've only met once or twice. And they both kind of, they were these converging vectors toward that barge, where some wreckage was found, and it was up to Emery to decide if the wreckage Scannon found was indeed this particular aircraft. And so when I arrived on that barge, I was kind of new to the scene. But since then, I too have been looking for answers. I mean, at that point, I had a magazine story to file, and I filed it. But we were still two to three years out from what happens at the end of the book. So the story was very much unfolding, and I found myself playing a role in it, a small role. because I could help search for information as a reporter.
And you did. I mean, and I you're a good reporter and a really good writer, and you're lucky to be able to kind of follow these things because of your reputation as a writer now, to be able to take a story like this and follow it the way you want to and live through that passion, which is a very, very good thing. But you also you brought the lives of many of the men and their families and their children and wives to light in this. That was a big piece of this book. It wasn't just a search for who what happened to these men, to Arnett and his crew and the rest of these people and who they were. And that fascinating story was to also talk about the lives of the Doyle family and even Scannon's family and his wife and the German connection and all the stuff you kind of had to bring out.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in the case of Pat Scannon, like Eric Emery, he had this backstory, and it took me a long time to get it from him. Pat's one of the most modest and people I've ever encountered, while also being one of the most interesting, which makes him a great subject to write about, but a sort of a terrible person to have to interview, because he doesn't love to talk about his story. He's content to have lived it and to have done it. What I found was that, you know, he was raised in a military family. There was a lot of pressure on him to join the military, and he did in fact enroll at West Point through a series of events that were a little bit outside of his control, and he left West Point partway through and ended up doing what he had initially wanted to do, which is following this path in science. But he felt this sort of deep respect for his forebears who had all served. And so I think in a lot of ways, and I've talked to Pat about this, his effort to do this work is his way of bringing the science that was his passion to the military service that he felt was his duty.
But one of the things you did here, the Doyle family, let's say, that has been devastated by this losing the father in this in the war, and never knowing what happened to him. The whole story about the son growing up, not sure if the father was dead or alive, and the father may have, he thought, had a second family, and that whole incredibly weird story.
Yeah.
But it's emblematic of all kinds of weird stories that come out when people can't find their loved ones in a war.
Right. I'd say as much as anything, that's what kept me focused on this. While I was first starting that reporting, within maybe a month or so of being on that barge, I encountered this family, the Doyle family, out in Snyder, Texas, who had a missing person, Jimmy Doyle, a gunner on the plane that they hoped they had found. And which the divers on the barge hoped they were going to be able to identify. And the whole extended family of this gunner, Jimmy Doyle, including his son Tommy and Jimmy's brothers, who are Tommy's uncles, had lived with this uncertainty that MIA families must endure. And like many MIA families, they had this optimistic story. I call them survival narratives. I don't know that there's a better term for it in the literature. I have not encountered one. The literature is unfortunately somewhat sparse in this area. But in these families, you often encounter a narrative in which there's some optimistic version of what may have happened and how the person may be alive. I say optimistic. Some of them are pretty traumatic. In some families, people believe that the missing person from World War II maybe survived a shipwreck or an airplane crash and swam to a small island and lived in a cave, or bumped their head, or got amnesia, or was being held, is still being held somewhere, captive somehow. And so they're often, you know, they're only optimistic in the sense that they would involve survival. They seem awfully painful. In some cases, they appear to be more painful than death. And it's one of the interesting characteristics of the MIA experience. With the Doyle family, the story that circulated was at once more strange and more substantial. The story that Tommy heard growing up from his uncles was that his father, Jimmy, had survived the crash, had somehow made his way to Asia, fallen in love, moved to California with a new wife, had two daughters, had called the family and spoken with the uncles, who had gone out to see him, but he escaped. He didn't want to be found just before they got there, and they were only able to confirm that he was living in this apartment in California by checking with the neighbors. this is an excruciating thing for Tommy and his mom to grow up hearing and believing, at least on some level. And, you know, just often enough, these kinds of stories do turn out to be true. So for MIA families, every time through the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, a Japanese soldier would emerge from the jungle for the first time to discover that the war was, in fact, over. when these events happen, most of us, you know, just see it as a peculiar, you know, two-column inch item in the newspaper. But for these MIA families, they provide this very central part of the narrative that shows that it is possible. And when you have direct family members who have experience, you can't know whether it's true or not. You know, you say, well, that sounds improbable. And Tommy Doyle thought that. He knew it sounded improbable. But he also loved his uncles, and he wanted to believe. And there was no way of knowing for sure because there was no concrete evidence of what happened to his father or any of the other 10 men who were on the same plane as Jimmy, or the plane itself vanished. It was said to go down in shallow water, and it simply wasn't there.
And that I love the great mystery tale of looking for this plane. We don't want to give part of that away, do we? No, I guess we don't.
It's your show. We can.
But I thought what Scanlon found and was able to kind of help some of the families realize that their loved ones, in fact, had died here.
Yeah,
the DNA can prove it.
Yeah,
they're there.
Every time Pat Scanlon finds a plane wreck. He mostly finds planes and not ships because of the nature of the combat as it took place in Palau. Every time he finds something, he brings the information, a complete and very, very detailed report to the military. And this is just his contribution as a citizen. You know, for 20 years, he and the friends who have formed up around him into an organization called the Bent Prop Project, they all fund their own way to fly out there and spend weeks every year, sometimes more than a month, searching for these airplanes. And when they find the airplanes, you know, having been to the archives, as you said, at College Park and having studied old aerial photography and everything else, and when they find a plane, they bring that information to the military in the form of this very polished report with all the archival evidence, all their, you know, studies that they've done of the site with magnetometry and side scan sonar and everything else. And it's at that moment up to the military to decide how to schedule an investigation and a recovery operation if they want to do so. In the cases where the military does recover and bring answers to families, it is an amazing thing to see how much that means to people still after all this time.
One of the things you do in this book as well is you take us through some of the combat scenes in the air.
Yeah.
Seeing 453 go down.
Yeah.
The combat before the pilots took over planes and what they experienced coming and seeing. And I think that one of the things that people don't realize is there was trauma for troops. Any trooper fighting in the middle of a war on the ground, there's trauma. Because in the middle of battle, and sometimes you're not in the middle of battle, there's trauma just because of the nature of being in that combat on ground situation. But people don't realize what happened to men in these, especially in World War II, in these planes.
Yeah.
Who were ripped apart inside these planes.
Yeah.
And the way you describe men who had their, you know, shrapnel tearing their guts apart. Inside the plane, and the plane still being in the air, and what happens when a plane is shot, and how it goes down, and the battle to keep the plane right and save people. These battle scenes were horrendous.
Really, really, really an incredible thing to conceive, and especially when set against the backdrop of what life was like for these guys on the base. You know, there's this enormous space in their combat experience between what they live and how they fight, and so they live. Way at the rear line and
it's, you know, paradise almost.
It's right? Almost like paradise on some of these islands. Some were awful, but yeah, some of them were great. I mean, mess halls with, you know, china and silverware and
beer, beaches.
Yeah, yeah, beer, right? And beaches, a lot of swimming, making sailboats and playing with, you know, parrots and monkeys and things. And then they had to get on the plane. And they had to fly forever, you know, 700, 1,000 miles. And as they're going, they're crossing over this invisible line on the water that marks enemy territory. And by the time they get to their target, they're so deep into enemy territory. You know, it's just these guys on their plane, with these other planes around them, getting torn apart by anti-aircraft fire from the ground.
And the Japanese Zeros coming in.
And the Zeros swooping up over them and dropping phosphorus bombs over them so that there's just this white hot fire liquid that's dripping down the clouds around them. And, you know, the contrast going back and forth between these environments day after day after day is a special kind of horror, because you can never acclimate to anything. And so I think it's a hard story to tell because, you know, I think for people who had someone in the Marines, for example, landing in a place like Tarawa, it's so, so bloody and so awful, or Guadalcanal.
Relentless.
And so it's tempting to look at these pilots and say, hey, they had it pretty good. They slept in a nice bed. And maybe there's some validity to that. But I think it's also true that, you know, if we work at it, we can understand that there's also this distinctive kind of trauma that happens to somebody who has to go from this comfortable place into the most awful, hellish firefight imaginable over and over and over again. And some of them couldn't do it. Some of them would turn back.
Turn back.
Yeah. Once in a while, you'd find somebody who just couldn't do it again, couldn't deliberately go into that environment again.
Right, just couldn't get in. And there were all these splits on the crews. Like one of the people we talked about, Kiefer Arnett, the captain, whose crew turned on him.
Yeah, yeah. There were tensions could arise, you know, because you're flying into certain devastation. You know that a lot of the planes in your group are going to get hit and go down. You know that a lot of your friends, you're going to have to watch them jumping off of aircraft in this, you know, blazing sky of fire, leaping off the aircraft as it's going down, hoping that their parachute opens, hoping that when they get down to the ground, they'll survive impact, they won't get captured, they'll somehow get rescued. So you're watching all of this every time you go. And you better have confidence, you know, in the guys on your plane, including the pilot and co-pilot, to be able to reduce your odds of being that plane that goes down.
So the big stoop, you can describe what that means.
Okay.
And also in context of this Flight 453, which is emblematic of all the planes that are missing, really.
Yeah. 453 is the plane that captured Pat Scannon's attention initially and consumed the first 10 years of his search and remains to this day the one that had the most mystery because it's the one that had Jimmy Doyle on it and the other 10 guys. All of their families had somewhat similar stories that really made this question curious as to how much truth there was in it. You know, certainly some men did parachute off the plane and did survive. And the question was which ones and what happened to them and how many. And so, you know, for this particular crew, as with many B-24 crews, you had guys from all over the country coming together. And their experience was a very brief period of training together in Tonopah and then maybe a quick stop in Hamilton Field, California, and a couple little islands on their way. But within a very short amount of time, they were expected to be on this, to form this band of brothers, if you will. I mean, the kinds of relationships that had to form among these men to serve successfully on an aircraft in the war are similar to those that had to be formed among ground troops. And so, you know, in this case, there was one of the great peculiarities of it was that the crew was flying that day with a pilot they had never flown with before. And the few people who in 1993, when Pat Scannon became interested in this plane, knew why, refused to say. So the mystery just continued to build, and there were no records to indicate why.
And this part of this book is also is a mystery story. It's an unraveling a mystery.
Yeah.
As many levels, the story does.
Yeah.
The way you've written this book. And I can tell that as a writer, this is a book that kind of, how can I put this? This is a book that I think that helped you, I'm just conjecturing here, man, find your place as a writer because you were able to take what you do is in magazine pieces, which are really good and thorough, but this book allowed you to tell the complexity of a story from it's just in terms of history, in terms of anthropology, in terms of individual human stories, a social commentary, looking at war and looking at individual lives and trying to find some peace. This is a very complex piece that you've tried to, layer here, I think.
You know, I appreciate that. I do feel that way. I do feel like I never really intended to write a book. I love the magazine form and I always have,
right.
You know. And I wrote this book because I couldn't let go of this story. And so it was I imagined at the outset that this was maybe going to be an isolated experience of trying to work in this medium. I think it's I think it became clear to me about halfway through the writing that I was falling in love with the form.
This is just the first of many books to come, and many magazines articles to come. Will, it's great to see you again.
You too.
Willis Hilton, Hylton, not like the hotel, Hylton, Vanished, the 60-year search for the missing men of World War II. You can meet him tonight, Thursday night, at the Wheeler Auditorium, plenty of room, at the Enoch Pratt Free Library, Central Branch, down on Cathedral Street at 6:30 p.m. He'll be talking about his book. I was going to introduce him tonight, but I have to go do another event at MedChi that I committed to before Will wrote me and asked me to do this. I wish I could. If I could be, I'd be there to introduce him. And he'll speak tonight, so don't miss this. This book is amazing. It's really worth a read. It will grip you just like a novel. Will Hilton's book, Vanished. Will, great to see you again.
You too. Thanks so much.
Hope you have a dynamite time tonight, and the place should be jammed. So be there at 6:30 to hear Will Hilton. And I'll remind you here that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information from MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is also at SteinerShow.org, where their banner lives. We're going to go out with Creole Love Calling, Duke Ellington and Adelaide Hall. It's the day she died, Adelaide Hall, one of the great figures of the Harlem Renaissance. We go out with her music. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. You can hear this show again, podcasts, our past shows, find information about our guests and the work they do on our website at SteinerShow.org. You can also now download, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.